Welcome, 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 beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. This week we seem to have been obsessed with the elections and their consequences. You'll recall me talking to Shapiro about the continuing efforts of the Republican Party to deny the vote to African Americans. We moved on to the Indonesian election last night, which was, I think, absolutely fascinating. And, of course, we gaze upon with wonderment at the consequences of a recent Senate election. Tonight we're off to Turkey to have a look at the presidential election, which is just weeks away. And our tour guide will be the admirable Hugh Pope, whose credentials are impressive. His books include Dining with Al-Qaeda, Three Decades Exploring the Many Worlds of the Middle East, Sons of the Conquerors, The Rise of the Turkic World, and Turkey Unveiled, A History of Modern Turkey. Much admired and showered with honours. And in just a minute, Hugh will join us. Then we're going to look at a part of the world where the election process is remarkably simple and where all the legislation gets through the upper house. I'm not sure they have an upper house. I must make inquiries. I speak, of course, of North Korea. But first of all, I've got two happy birthdays. This is something we don't normally do, but they're very significant. One of them is to my old mate, Gough Whitlam, our former PM, who turns 98 tomorrow. Today, if you're listening to the repeat, good on you, comrade EGW. And the other goes to someone whose birthday, well, there's would you believe, an 80-year difference. The other is Billy, the son of my marvellous executive producer. I got to know young Billy very well when our two families circumnavigated China together when we were piling up programmes. So happy birthday to Gough, and happy birthday to Bill. Now, the upcoming Turkish elections, presidential elections, are likely to see Prime Minister Erdogan currently embroiled in corruption allegations for deals with the Kurdistan Workers' Party become the country's first popularly elected president. He's a political survivor par excellence, and as a builder of roads and shopping centres, he's consistently maintained support despite controversial paternalistic media bans, protester deaths, ongoing oppositional demos that began in Istanbul's Gezi Park in May last year. And if his AKP party goes on to win the 2015 elections, that will guarantee his one-man rule pretty much until 2019. So here's Hugh Pope, to help us pull apart this shifting Turkish puzzle that is, I guess, Islamic progressivism. And Hugh, incidentally, is Istanbul-based and he's Deputy Program Director at the International Crisis Group for Europe and Asia. Hugh, at the end of March, Turkey had its nationwide municipal elections in which Turkey's longest-serving and patriarchal Prime Minister had a personal victory, and he wasn't even on the ballot.
Yes, he has had amazing electoral successes and good luck, in fact, ever since he entered politics. But he's worked hard for it, and I think he's managed to sweep all before him by being the kind of strong, manly, electable and also effective leader that most Turks want to see in office, whatever all the peccadilloes that you mentioned might also be.
The president of Turkey, Abdullah Gül, is with Erdogan currently in the role of the prime minister. I suspect, or I put it to you, that Gül is a sort of puppet president, pretty much like Medvedev was for Putin.
The relationship has been compared to the two, and certainly the man with the political power is Prime Minister Erdogan. He controls the party, he controls the patronage networks, he decides who does what. However, it has to be said that Abdullah Gül for quite a while had more Twitter followers than Erdogan. It certainly seems to be more popular, and obviously has the easier job since he is able to sit in the presidency and be a benign paternal figure over Turkey. And it has, however, become clear, especially after that March election in which the Prime Minister's party got nearly 45% of the vote, that Gül, who had distanced himself from Erdogan, was just not able to mount any kind of competition.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if your paths haven't crossed at some point with an old friend of ours, Tony Benn. And I'm reminded of what Tony says or said about all political leaders in all countries, irrespective of system or era. He says they come in one of three categories, straight men, fixers or maddies. I can apply that to pretty much to the Australian model. What about this bloke? Is he a straight man, a fixer, a maddie, or an interesting combination?
I think he's more of a combination between a big, writ large mayor of Turkey and a businessman. He's very, very interested in, as you put it earlier, in building roads, building shopping centres, building the biggest airport in the world, and genuinely supercharging the economy of Turkey as far as he can. And in that sense, he's something of a fixer. You know, for foreign investors, when they needed things done and they were working with his team, you know, he couldn't really make things happen quickly. So he's that kind of person.
Remind the listener what sparked the famous park demos that began in May 2013.
A combination of things, but above all, a sense that after 10 years in power, that the Prime Minister had perhaps lost touch. I think that he was out of the country when it developed and hadn't quite realised the extent of popular feeling about the placing of yet another shopping mall in the middle of the last speck of green in the middle of Turkey's biggest city. And somehow the protests that started on a very small scale caught the imagination of the public, and it snowballed into a very heterogeneous collection of voices from every possible point on the political spectrum, but generally united behind a kind of street call for the Prime Minister to resign was possibly the politest way it was expressed. He struggled to get ahead of that one because I think he hadn't understood quite the extent of frustration, especially in Istanbul's youth, that the way that the government had appearing to take decisions without any reference to opinion in the city.
Now, there are some very superficial parallels involving newfangled media and smartphones, but we're not really talking about Taksim Square, are we?
There was an element of new wave media and Twitter, but I think it was a genuinely surprisingly spontaneous event, and as many of the protesters I was speaking to were just angry with the police, so they stayed out there rather than going home.
But unlike their counterparts in Cairo, they weren't in the business of overthrowing an entire political system. They just wanted some fine tuning.
That's right, and the fact is that Turkey is in no way as badly run as Egypt, and frankly, the Turkey has been called a model for the Middle East. It's obviously always been a bit exaggerated, but the reason that many Middle Easterners come to Istanbul for their holidays and to show their families around, go shopping, is because it is pretty well run, and the taxing protests were not seeking to overthrow the entire constitutional order of the country now.
Hugh, what's the quality of media in Turkey?
Well, we have a lot of well-publicised problems with freedom of expression in Turkey, especially in recent years as the government has become so dominant. The strange thing is that there is an enormous amount of free speech in Turkey. If you walk down an average main street and you look at the titles of the newspapers on the pavement, you would be amazed at the insults that are heaped on the Prime Minister and the caricatures of him looking awful. But it should be said that these are in a way marginal, because the Prime Minister has managed to get the control of or support of possibly 80% of the mainstream media. So he owns the choir and the congregation, I think, at the moment.
On Monday, the police officer accused of killing a protester during the demonstrations in Ankara in June was arrested by a Turkish criminal court, but that did not satisfy the Republican People's Party, the main opposition.
This kind of thing is never ending in Turkey. There are people in prison for reasons that are completely bizarre and would be considered unthinkable elsewhere, and yet at the same time there is elementary justice at the as well in parallel with this, and I'm afraid that people who are in the state system or in the security forces always get lighter treatment unless they happen to have gone politically against the Prime Minister, in which case they find themselves in jail for years.
Now, the barracks which were to be rebuilt under Erdogan were replicas of those demolished when Ataturk, the progressivist father of the secular Turkish state, invited a French urban planner along to modernize Istanbul. So it's a site of older resonances, isn't it?
But I think Prime Minister Erdogan was very aware of that when he commissioned this or oversaw the shopping center plans that would have recreated externally the image of this very Baroque version of Orientalist architecture that was the Taksim Square barracks in the old days. He's very aware, and he's talked about it in the past, that these barracks were the center of a royalist, I suppose in modern day terms it would be called pro-Islamic revolution against a modernist secularist faction, and there was actually an army marched on Istanbul in those days and crushed the Islamist revolution in those same barracks. And Prime Minister Erdogan used words to describe the Taksim processes as being the same as these 1909 counter-revolutionaries, if you like. So, yeah, he makes the connection, and he is constantly portraying himself as an extension of what he sees as the really great Turkey of the Ottoman Empire.
To come back to the present, the Justice and Development Party, AKP, to which he belongs, won 45% of the vote in the March municipals. That's a remarkable margin. How can we reconcile his success with his shortcomings? Have we got to factor in a very charismatic personality, Hugh?
Yes, people say they vote for him just because of the way he walks. I mean, it's amazing when you think of the things he's been accused of and been tape recordings of the way he has spoken about arranging things. The people still stick with him is an extraordinary phenomenon. But no one questions the legitimacy of the vote. On the margins, but the bulk of the votes are considered to be real votes for him. And it's because he's a very good speaker. He's very good at picking fights. He's very good at all the short-term, day-to-day politics that are vital in any country to stay on top of the machine. And he's also blessed with the fact that the opposition has been completely unable to produce anybody of his stature.
It was interesting when we were discussing the Indonesian election last night that a huge amount of Republican, US Republican Party political technology, if you like, was imported, you know, the same sort of spin doctors that George W. used, and it really followed an American sort of model. Is that the case with a Turkish election?
The symbol that Prime Minister Erdogan is using for his campaign has been widely compared to the symbol that President Obama used for his re-election, a kind of arch with a rising sun and Prime Minister Erdogan. Being Prime Minister Erdogan's got a road going towards that horizon. But lots of razzmatazz, very well organized. And, you know, his principal advantage is that he is the undisputed leader of Turkey. He has got full control of the state apparatus, and he's using it to his heart's content.
I'm talking to Hugh Pope, Istanbul-based journalist and these days deputy program director of the International Crisis Group. And as I said earlier, his books a required reading if you want to understand the region. Now, in his victory speech, he vowed revenge on the party's enemies. To make sense of his motives for revenge and its target, we have to mention the almost and perhaps overstated battle for the future of Turkey that's gone on between him and the influential Sunni cleric Fethullah Gulen. Can you tell us about that?
The venom in this conflict probably comes from the fact that the two were actually allies before and represent elements of the same constituency. Premier Erdogan is now has his own, as it were, state-based constituency and is not ever tried to formalize any kind of religious standing, whereas Fethullah Gulen is very different, and the movement is very different. It's very international. They have schools all over the world. They have business followers all over the world. And the two have gone head-to-head over the last year, and frankly, I think that Erdogan has had so much power in Turkey that he's been able to I would think crush is not too big a word, their opposition to him. But he also uses it as a rhetorical device to rally his people behind him and to show that he is acting strong and walking tall, which is the basis of his charisma.
In the election just passed, the suspicion, at least on his side, is that Gulen was behind some leaked tapes that supported corruption claims against the PM and his cabinet.
Possibly. I have no secret information about this, but conspiracies abound, and yes, he's certainly blaming them for it, yes.
Okay, let's turn to the key items on the political agenda. The economy is one of the government's political strengths, but Iraq, Turkey's second largest trading partner, now threatens to be destabilised by ISIS. Now, what will the president's election strategy be on this issue?
To stop anybody talking about it whatsoever. I mean, there's actually a court ruling forbidding anybody to mention the very embarrassing capture of Turkey's consul general in the city of Mosul in northern Iraq, and I think 48 or 49 members of diplomatic staff, which Turkey is currently negotiating the release of. I mean, it's not very widely known in the outside world, but you could imagine what sort of a stink this would normally raise in most countries, especially, which would be especially embarrassing at an election time, given that one would presume that a government would normally have removed diplomatic staff before such an event was about to happen. However, this represents part of the collapse of the Middle East policy of Turkey over the last few years. It's not just the rise of the Islamic State in northern Iraq and north Syria. It's been the loss of relationships with Syria, the complete collapse of relationship with Egypt, and the never-ending rows with Israel. I mean, nothing seems to be going right. So this is clearly something that Turkey has to work out a defense strategy for. And for now, it's, I think, mainly, let's not talk about it.
It's interesting that seems to have worked, Hugh, because you're also describing a very energetic media scene, both mainstream media and the new technologies. But it has, in fact, suppressed the debate.
Certainly suppressed the debate about what happened to those kidnapped diplomats. I think the fact is that most people in Turkey are not really looking at the Middle East most of the time. It's something that we policy wonks look at and say this is going to mean trouble for Turkey. But until the big bomb goes off somewhere, and God forbid that it should, but then I think Turkey will continue to act as if nothing much is happening. And the fact is, it's a very big country. We have more than a million Syrian refugees here in Turkey at the moment, and they're being looked after with actually rather extraordinary generosity. And even though most people, I think, are dissatisfied with the policies which led to the way Syria has imploded and resulted in all those refugees coming to Turkey, you very rarely hear people actually blaming the government for the extra burden that the country is carrying.
And yet the treasury is pretty bare. You know, there's a lot of financial problems, and Turkey's exports, according to Moody's, that is, could decline by 15% if the fighting between ISIS and Iraq continues.
Yes, Iraq is Turkey's traditionally second or third biggest trading partner, and you're right that to put your finger on this economic question, because one of the things that is the wave that has kept Erdogan surfing, as it were, is the fact that he's been very lucky with the economy. And even in the 2008 downturn, because Turkey's banking system had been cleaned up about 7 years earlier, they didn't have the really jaw-dropping moment that the rest of Europe had. But right now, I think that there's a very bubbly feeling, obviously, in international markets. But Turkey is the one southern European country with a building boom, with an export-led boom, all the things that we're familiar with that hasn't gone pop yet. And if that should ever happen, I think that would be the moment that Erdogan would face real difficulty explaining the situation to his people.
Now, of course, Turkey's relationship with the EU has fascinated the world, for which it's an ever-prospective member. But that's been strained recently by the Turkish economy minister's warning that he may pull out of EU-US trade talks, or if they leave out Ankara.
We'll see what Turkey actually does. There's a lot of talk, the main thing about Turkey and the EU is that I think Turkey's been taking something for granted for a few years. People forget that it is the EU accession process that has been the key to unlocking the dramatic rise in foreign investment in Turkey. And three quarters of Turkey's foreign investment does come from EU states. And this was on the basis of the idea that Turkey had somehow got an anchor that it was really going to obey international standards and converge with EU norms and have a sort of sanctity of contract and all these things. And that encouraged boardrooms all over the world to start making flashing green lights for investment. But we've seen that go into reverse recently as people become more worried about how Turkey's being governed.
Now, a Turkish film, Winter Sleep, won the Palme d'Or quite recently, and a Chekhovian family drama in which the director, first of all, the director dedicates the film to slain protesters, but apparently the film addresses the subtleties of class problems and also for the director, the widening gap between the generations in Turkey.
There's lots of fault lines in Turkey, and as long as the economy is humming, as long as the country generally feels as though it's headed in the right direction, most people rub along perfectly well. It's and I think that's actually still the case. You know, despite 30 years of Kurdish-Turkish tensions over the PKK insurgency and Turkey's rather blind policies of discrimination against the Kurds, which are gradually being worked out, the Turks and Kurds do seem to still get along. And that's because I think things have the country's broadly is enjoying economic expansion, a sense of convergence with the rest of the world, and a sense of a certain sense of excitement that things are getting better in the country. But if these things start sliding into reverse, then you do have moments of great polarization. And the difference between the secularists and Islamists in Turkey, for instance, as expressed in the difference between the AK Party and the Republican People's Party, are often also very much class differences between rural or newly urbanized folk and the old urban populations.
Let's look at this border that you recently travelled. It's a 911-kilometre border with Syria, and with a large ethnic Kurdish population on either side of the frontier. You were talking about the scale of the refugee problem from the Syrian crisis, and that's now entering what its fourth year. The cost and the political problems of this are almost incalculable.
We're never quite sure how much it's costing Turkey, but we think it's $3 billion. And the extraordinary thing is that only about 200 million of that has actually come from the outside world. Turkey has carried this burden itself. At the same time, as being very open to the Syrian refugees, about a fifth of them are in camps that are considered to be some of the best refugee camps in the world. And the others have been allowed to integrate in Turkish cities to an extraordinary extent. They're given free access to hospitals. They're given the right to work if they wish. And you even hear Turkish cabinet ministers speaking privately about how this is actually sort of rather good for the economy, because people can find cheap labor. And certainly in rural Turkey, you can find Syrians now doing all kinds of work. And so Turkey's really absorbed that, but it's coming to the limit of what Turkey can do without outside help. And it's really time for, you know, especially for Europe, if they want to ensure that the Syrians don't move on from Turkey, they're going to have to do more to support Turkey in its efforts to help these people.
Nonetheless, to hear of this scale of operation and the decency of it, really, is an object lesson to Australia, where we go into a political frenzy and into meltdown if we get a boatload of, you know, of 300 people trying to escape Sri Lanka. You've got 220,000 Syrians living in camps in Turkey. 220,000. Now, there have been claims that Erdogan has actively supported the al-Nusra Front, which is a jihadist faction in the rebel opposition in Syria. Do you give that credence?
I think in the early days, when Prime Minister Erdogan was really betting very heavily on the quick removal of President Assad in Damascus, that he was willing to back almost anyone. And I think in Ankara, I met officials certainly who would say, look, you know, these are people who can get the job done. They don't represent the mass of Syrians. Once the revolution succeeds, they will be sidelined. And unfortunately, I think that's the same logic that people in Mosul also had when they may or may not have helped the Islamic State capture that city last month. And, you know, we've already seen, you know, these are kind of Bolshevist factions that push everyone else aside. And unfortunately, I think what we're seeing from Turkey's perspective is that they have fed a monster. Even if I to be fair to Turkey, I think they were never actually fully backing these jihadist factions. They were allowing others to help them, was more the case. But they have allowed a monster to be fed that has now bit them.
Okay, now we should mention that after the presidential elections in August, there'll be a general election next year. Will this be exuberantly fought, or is it a foregone conclusion?
I think that it will be difficult for the next government to continue this sort of uninterrupted run of AK Party successes, especially since the president cannot, in good faith, be the person running the campaign, much as it seems that Prime Minister Erdogan talks as though he's going to still be running the country as before. And by the way, he's building a vast building on the outskirts of the capital, Ankara, which will house the new executive offices of almost everything. It's hard to predict that result. Again, so much depends on what happens to the economy over the next year. It's also very hard for us here at Crisis Group, for instance, to predict which of the issues we cover are going to be able to be acted upon now, or will it be in a year's time? Because, you know, will the Prime Minister be, if he gets to be elected president, will his eyes be on maximizing political support for his ex-party?
We've got to wind it up, Hugh. I'm sorry, we're completely out of time, but I thank you for that. Hugh Pope, Istanbul-based journalist and deputy program director at the International Crisis Group for Europe and Central Asia. The program is now heading off to matters North Korean. LNL on RN. Good on you, Hugh.